It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from an opponent of the so-called Right to Try initiative, which Arizona voters will decide on later this year. Supporters say the measure would give seriously ill people the opportunity to try potentially life-saving drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA. Also, an internal investigation has begun at the Attorney General's office. Critics are unhappy the investigation is being run by two lawyers, John Cadis and David Derrickson, who have given financial support to Attorney General Tom Horn in the past. I'll talk with former U.S. Attorney Mel McDonald, who has served as a special prosecutor and investigator several times. Plus, you may not know the second most practiced religion in Arizona behind Christianity is Hindu. I'll talk with a University of Arizona professor about why that may be, and we'll take you inside a Phoenix Hindu temple. We start today's program with the conflict between an assistant professor of English at Arizona State University and a campus police officer in Tempe. Ursula Orr was crossing near 5th Street and College Avenue and jaywalked. Officer Stuart Farron approached Orr and asked for her ID. When Orr didn't cooperate, Farron decided to handcuff Orr. It escalated from there, with Farron taking Orr down to the ground. His action led to an eyewitness calling 911 to report excessive force. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office has decided to press criminal charges against Orr, who has pleaded not guilty to aggravated assault of an officer. Some are concerned that Orr, who is African-American, may have been racially profiled by Farron, since he appeared to aggressively pursue her merely for jaywalking. So what's the right approach in the situation for anyone in law enforcement? I'm joined by Rabbi Stephen Berg, the Eastern Director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center and Museum of Tolerance. Rabbi Berg, how are you? Thanks for being with us.
Good. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So one training course Museum of Tolerance offers is Tools for Tolerance for Law Enforcement. What are the basics of that training?
Well, we've run that training over 20 years. We've had over about 165,000 officers come through, but a lot of that training talks about being tolerant. And, you know, we find is with law enforcement officers, people forget that they're just regular people kind of thrust into a role where they have, you know, somewhat a power over other people. And sometimes it's tough to figure out when to use it, when not to use it, you know, when to use force, when not to use force, you know, racial profiling. Here in New York, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, stop and frisk and things of that nature. And what we do is we basically work with the officers. We have all kinds of videos and scenarios that we go through to talk about, you know what kind of situations, you know, maybe there are better ways to handle things. And a lot of it is getting them to talk themselves about what it's like out there.
How many different people are involved in doing the training? And are they from different walks of life? Are they in spirituality? Are they in law enforcement themselves?
Our trainers are all retired law enforcement.
Okay.
Because one of the things that we found really early on is that law enforcement officers are very comfortable with people that have, quote-unquote, walked in their shoes.
Mm.
And, you know, I'll just give you an example. One of our trainers here spent 20 years in the force. His name's Oscar Odom. He's a lawyer today, and he's actually wrote his doctorate on stop and frisk. So, you know, they have a lot of credibility, you know, because they've been in their shoes. But on the other hand, they have a lot of, like, kind of world knowledge, and a lot of them are at universities and so forth.
How big a concern should it be generally, whether it's New York or anywhere else around the country, that law enforcement officers know how to deal with a situation that requires their presence, perhaps, but to not even come up to that line where some may see it as racial profiling?
Oh, I think it's a huge concern. It's a concern for everyone. You know, one of the things that we have in our Museum of Tolerance is we have an exhibit called The Power of Words. And that's one of the things we talk about, you know, handling a situation with your words, you know, as opposed to force or excessive force or any type of force. I mean, I think the ideal situation is, you know, when a law enforcement person can de-escalate the situation. And a lot of it has to do with body language. A lot of it has to do with, you know, how they handle it, what they say, and so forth. So I think it's a hugely important, because, you know, the law enforcement really is the face of public government for the people out there. And you know, it could be incredible and work out well, or it could be abused.
So much of training is making it so when a situation arises, the person remembers what the training is. There's been that sort of repeatable action, those repeatable words. How much training does there need to be done to get to that point? So it's not something in the back of a law enforcement officer's mind, but it's actually up front saying, okay, I'm going into this situation. This is how I need to handle it.
Well, I think there has to be constant training. I think that's one of the things that that a lot of law enforcement agencies probably don't put enough emphasis on, is the need for training and retraining, and just how to dialogue and how to, you know, speak to people, how to deal with people, and things of that nature. And you know, the flip side is also, you never know what's going on. We see the officer as just like all one and the same. You never know when that officer has had a bad day or there's something going on at home and all those things. And, you know, and they're normal people. And it's absolutely inexcusable, but a lot of times, you know, that'll come out. And they have to guard against that. When they're on the job, they can't bring, you know, other issues and other problems to work with them.
Right. We expect our law enforcement officers to be able to handle dangerous and not so dangerous situations with the same sort of professionalism and humanity. How much work has to go into that? I mean, how much is that something where it's just about shining a little bit? Or in some cases, do you really have, based on the training that's been done, are there some people you really have to turn around?
Yeah, again, it depends. It's such a broad spectrum of law enforcement officers out there and stuff. And even, you know, we kind of group them together. But, you know, we deal with Department of Corrections. You know, for them, it's a whole different story. They're 24/7 with criminals and, you know, being bombarded by all kinds of issues. And even trying to have them maintain their dignity and how to deal with people within prisons is difficult. You know, and the outside law enforcement, there's all kinds of different agencies. So, yeah, it really runs the gamut. You know, we'll have groups in here of law enforcement. Officers who have done something wrong or said something wrong, and that's why they get sent here. Mm-hmm. And we'll have, you know, cadets that are, you know, everything is yes, sir, and they'll salute and, you know, all and everywhere in between. And that's the challenge. The challenge is to work with everyone where they're at. And I think the important piece is to get them to talk, to really get them to open up and get to. That's why I think we've been so successful, is because it's not something within, you know, the precinct house, or it's not something within their area where their superiors are there. It's a safe place where they can come and kind of talk about what their thoughts and feelings are.
You mentioned how long the training has been going on for a couple of decades. What has changed in the post 9/11 world as far as law enforcement officers, their approach to diversity?
You know, I'll be honest with you. I think that law enforcement in general is more diverse than it's ever been in terms of the people that make up the law enforcement. So that I think we've seen that shift. But also, you know, in the place of terrorism, you know, one of our main museums is in New York City. There's really, you know, post 9/11, I think people were really on edge, and I think that people were going to err on the side of you know, call caution. And I think now the pendulum is swinging back a little bit, especially, you know, with getting rid of stop and frisk here in New York, that they're thinking maybe it went too far. And I'm not here to take a side in that debate, but I think that they're really kind of wrestling. But I definitely think that we've seen since post 9/11 people more vigilant, and, you know, if people, you know, terrorism and all those other issues, that people are taking them a lot more seriously.
Rabbi Stephen Berg is the Eastern Director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center and Museum of Tolerance in New York. Rabbi Berg, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and good luck with your show.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. In May, Colorado became the first state to approve so-called right-to-try legislation. Supporters say it will allow terminally ill patients to use experimental medications that haven't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Arizonans will have the opportunity to vote on a right-to-try ballot initiative in the fall. 2 weeks ago, we talked with initiative supporter Paulina Morris. She says her support is personal. Her son Diego had been treated with chemotherapy for osteosarcoma.
It was brought to our attention that there was a drug that was showing very promising results with osteosarcoma patients in trials here in the United States. And the drug was approved in just about every other country. And we decided we needed to get that drug for our child and save his life and move to London for 9 months. And we want to make sure that children and adults, people here in Arizona, have access to drugs that haven't gone through the lengthy FDA process, but have passed basic safety tests, and make it available to people here in Arizona.
Today we're hearing from an opponent of Proposition 303, the so-called Right to Try initiative. She is Joan Corber Walker, President and CEO of the Arizona Bioindustry Association. Joan, thanks for being here today.
Oh, Steve, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
I know you have a lot of concerns. Let's start with ethics first and the position this could potentially put medical professionals in and drug makers in.
So, you know, first I want to preface this statement with the right to try, the ability for any human being to fight for their life, is a basic. It's inherent in all of us. And here in Arizona, there are over 20,000 researchers and over 100,000 health professionals who have dedicated their lives to helping all patients, not just one patient. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the right to try, The challenge with Proposition 303, which is the right to try, is that it provides for the ability for a patient to try, but not their ability to succeed. And the reasons for that are that the right to try proposition conflicts with federal law. And our healthcare professionals are governed by federal law. So a pharmacy, even if the pharmacy wanted to give the patient the drug so it could be administered at a hospital under the appropriate levels of care, they are not allowed to because of the federal regulations that they are bound by. The same applies for physicians and others. Now, in the proposed proposition, should it become law, those healthcare providers would be protected in Arizona under Arizona law. But they're not protected under federal law. And so what would happen is if, God forbid, a patient received treatment with an experimental drug that is very early, and that patient did not have a good outcome, the result could be that that doctor, that hospital, that drug company could be sued in federal court. And based on the advice of counsel, both in Colorado and in Arizona, as these laws were moving through the legislature, those companies, those doctors, those hospitals would lose because federal law would apply in a federal court.
So again, Arizona state versus federal, and you never know if things could be implemented even if Arizona voters wanted it.
The reality is that they cannot be implemented.
Let's talk a little bit about the FDA approval process now, Joan. There have been some changes in the past few years to speed up the process or make it more efficient.
Yes.
What do you think about that process as it works now, considering, because it seems like that's why there's a popularity of a right to try, because the feeling is, well, if another country is approving, as we heard from Paulina there, well, why don't we have that next yet in the USA?
Well, I think the things that we have to look at, and it's a very complex issue, and it's an issue that is actually being addressed right now by Congress. So right now in the House of Representatives, the Commerce and Energy Committee is holding meetings on what's called the 21st Century Cures Initiative. And that is bringing together legal experts, patient groups, as well as the FDA, where both Commissioner Hamburg as well as Janet Woodcock are extremely engaged in this process to try and make it better. Now, the other thing that's important to note, and this is one of the real challenges with a state-based right to try, is that the FDA does have what's called an extended access program. And so this is where a patient who is not in a clinical trial for whatever reason, can apply to the FDA to get access to these life-saving drugs. This is exactly what Right to Try is talking about. And that process, when a physician with a patient goes through the process, it is very unlikely that the FDA will say no if it will help the patient. And they will look at risk versus benefit. So from that perspective, there is a path. And if we start sending people down a dead-end path with state-based right to try legislation, then remember, these are terminally ill patients. And the thing that they have the least of is time. Wasting their time is criminal. And so we need to be working at all levels, state, region, industry, federal, to ensure that we have the best potential pathway for those patients. And that's what's being done right now. This Proposition 303 will tell someone that they have a chance to go another way. If they go down that path, they will waste time, and time's what they don't have.
And Joan, I know we wouldn't endorse this concept, but I'm sure we've both maybe known people, but certainly heard of people who have tried to go to different countries, even Mexico, where there are stories of people going down there to try experimental treatments. If someone is in that position of being terminally ill, I guess I wonder, haven't they already lost hope at some point anyway? I think there's that. I understand you wouldn't necessarily want this to be government endorsed, but at some point people are sort of saying, well, I might as well try something because otherwise I may just be gone in 6 months.
Right. We have, in the United States, we all have the freedom to travel. And so there are cases where people will go to other countries, as you heard in the case of Paulina Morris, to access a particular treatment. And obviously, I haven't researched her case,
right,
so I can't speak to that, you know, beyond that. However, what we have to keep in mind is that if you're going to travel to get treatment at a reputable healthcare facility, and that treatment is available and it works for you as a patient, I don't know anyone in the medical community that's against that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, for every good time that has happened, there have been cases where people, again, have wasted time and money to pursue a pathway because they didn't want to go down the traditional path. And we've seen that in very, very, very famous cases.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that, you know, in cases of others. When you go outside the system, you run the risk of being taken advantage of at your most vulnerable time.
I think this may fall into that category, but I know you're concerned about sort of the Hollywoodization of things. And the Dallas Buyers Club is sort of the example of that film.
Yeah.
This idea that we need to have this freedom to do this. Talk a little bit about that, would you?
You know, it's interesting. When you talk to people in industry, that is probably one of the most difficult times in our history. We were coming up with new investigational drugs. There was a huge global effort to address what was happening with HIV and AIDS.
This was early to mid-1980s?
It was about 82, 83.
Okay.
And so new drugs were being brought forward. They were actually being fast-tracked through the FDA. And that was actually shown in the movie. And remember, a movie's a movie. It's not necessarily fact. And while it makes for a fabulous story, it doesn't necessarily make for good policy. And so, again, we need to go back to how do we work within the system to fix the system as opposed to going around it.
Joan Korber-Walker, President and CEO of the Arizona Bio Industry Association. Joan, obviously, we'll talk about this in the months to come, but thanks for taking time with us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you for your support.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with former Special Prosecutor Mel McDonald about what's going on in Tom Horn's office, and later, we'll take you to a Hindu temple in Phoenix. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Across Arizona Tours, providing daily sightseeing tours for individuals and corporate groups. Tour descriptions, rates, and tour guide profiles at AcrossArizonaTours.com. A member of Local First Arizona.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Valley forecast calling for sunny skies today and a high near 110 degrees. It'll be clear overnight with a low in the upper 80s. In Valley traffic on the State Route 51, the southbound exit ramp at Glendale Avenue is now clear. It's mostly sunny and 100 degrees right now at KJZZ at 1124.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Investigations that are focused on Attorney General Tom Horn are nothing new, but now the AG's office has opened an internal investigation that will be led by a couple of outside lawyers, lobbyist and former state lawmaker John Cadis and Dave Derrickson, who's a criminal defense attorney. Some critics have expressed concerns that both Cadis and Derrickson have donated to Horn campaigns in the past. Special investigators and special prosecutors have been busy in Arizona in recent years. I turned to one of them, Mel McDonald, for his perspectives. McDonald served as a special Maricopa County prosecutor looking into the State Department of Corrections after the lengthy Lewis State Prison standoff a decade ago. What are the important questions any special investigator, any special prosecutor needs to ask himself or herself before taking the job?
The first question would be, what team are you going to assemble to work with you in the investigation? I have always, when I've done special investigations, reached out to employ investigators that were highly competent, that had unblemished reputations, because that adds integrity to the investigation so that people won't accuse you of doing something that's politically motivated.
Well, but they probably still will, though, right? But you're going to be above reproach regardless of what they say.
You're always going to face that. And I've noticed in this particular case, they look and the investigators are have been supporters of Tom Horn, and they've given political donations in the past. These are all items that come with the territory. So what I typically try to do at the very outset is to assemble a team, often a bipartisan team, Republican and Democrats, people with law enforcement backgrounds, to work with me in carrying out the investigation.
I wonder, is there a perspective that a person who has had federal experience as well as a local experience, how important is it to have dipped your toe into all those waters?
Yeah, I think it's very important. I know Dave Derrickson, who has been selected, was a colleague of mine on the Superior Court bench. Dave has been a defense attorney and a judge. John Katus, I know, had been at the legislature for many years and is a private attorney. I think it's important, especially when you realize if you're the same party as Tom Horn, to try to instill confidence in the report, to surround yourself with investigators that are going to be working with you that could possibly deflect that criticism.
One other thing that comes into when one becomes a special prosecutor or special investigator is clearly, obviously, that means there's controversy that's been brewing. How difficult, how challenging is that to step into first, even before you start the investigation?
Well, I think the objective that I've always wanted in an investigation, and people will always find reason to criticize it, but you want to assemble a team and clearly define your issues so that when criticism comes, it is easily deflected. And in many of the controversial interviews, I will put into that scenario investigators whose credentials are unimpeached, who have sterling reputations, because at the end of the day, you want the public to believe in the integrity of what you've done.
In 2004, there was the Lewis State Prison standoff, which was daunting. That was lengthy. How did you get involved in that? What were the results of the investigation there?
Well, I had been asked by the county attorney, Rick Romley, because I think he was contemplating at the time running for governor. He didn't want to have that investigation tainted. At the time, Janet Napolitano was the governor, and there'd been a lot of criticism of the governor and of Doris Hero, who was the director of the Department of Corrections. And so I was asked to look at the Lewis Prison hostage case. Once again, I assembled this same team that I'd had in the impeachment. There may have been a couple of people different, but to me, the important thing was to get people of unimpeachable integrity and reputation involved in the interview process. We literally had our team go into the state prison, interview inmates. I personally interviewed the two detention officers that had been held hostage. And our objective was to identify criminal acts where they existed, to make recommendations to the governor and to the public, if you will, of what security measures could be made in the future, and then to look at the decisions that had been made to form opinions on whether they were good decisions or bad decisions.
Mel, to the current situation involving Attorney General Tom Horn, he has denied all the allegations against him, all some campaign finance related, some in this case the idea that his Attorney General's office was being used for campaign work during on-duty hours. What are you watching as far as what you're paying attention to as someone with experience in being involved in investigations like this? And also from a public standpoint, how should the public view when allegations are made against, in essence, the biggest law firm in the state? Should there be concern that there are allegations against that office?
And I've read the newspaper and I've heard the news media about the criticism. There have been criticisms that the investigators donated to Mr. Horn's campaign, and I'm aware of those. I think the first challenge for them would be to assemble a team, if you will, like I did, of people with unimpeachable reputations for law enforcement and investigative skills and for integrity. one of the other things you strive for is to be able to interview and to participate and investigate and win the cooperation of as many people as you possibly can. I've noticed that the accuser has now, through her lawyer, insisted that she's not going to meet with them and answer any questions, but I still think they can go forward with an investigation. That said, I know Dave Derrickson, and I know John Katus. I don't think these are people that, because they gave a political contribution, would be swayed with their investigative findings. But that said, it's not what I believe, but what the public perception would be.
The Attorney General spokesman has said that once the results are in by the investigators, they won't be released publicly. Should the public expect these results to be released publicly, or at least available publicly?
Obviously, at some point, I think if public monies are being paid, that is something that probably ought to be published at some point in time. Obviously, what people are doing with this report is they're building it in issues. Attorney General Horn is up for election, and it's these issues seem to be driving a lot of the campaign. So much of this kind of stuff gets twisted and turned with politics, and I think what, if I was in his shoes, what I'd try to do is to do my best to neutralize that criticism that's going to come out. If you're going to pay up to $50,000 for a report, you want it's something that people will look at and that they will believe and they'll accept.
Former U.S. Attorney and former Special Prosecutor Mel McDonald chiming in on the Tom Horn investigation. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Election season is picking up in a dramatic way, with campaign finance reports coming in and candidates complaining about how their opponents are portraying them. So when the mud starts flying, it's time to turn to the dean of the Arizona Capitol Press Corps, Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Howie, good morning.
Good morning. I love how you relate me with mud, but that's okay.
Well, we've known each other for a long time, Howie, so truth is truth.
Yes.
Former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith has made accusations against State Treasurer Doug Ducey's gubernatorial campaign. What are his attorneys saying about what Ducey is doing?
In essence, it comes down to the question of whether there's illegal coordination between what was supposedly an independent expenditure, which took some ads, about Scott Smith when he was ending his term as Mayor of Mesa, with Ducey's actual campaign. I mean, you're using the same consultants, seem to be using the same material. Are you doing the same opposition research? It becomes one of those circumstantial questions of, can you show coordination here? And that's essentially what it is. You know, there's nothing illegal about the independent committee as long as it's truly independent. This is the same fight we went through with the Tom Horn case. The question becomes, was there coordination there? And if so, any money spent by this committee that was attacking Scott Smith is money that was really spent on behalf of Doug Ducey and may violate campaign finance laws.
Howie, Tom Collins of the Clean Elections Commission might not like me asking this question, but when it comes down to these things, when there are accusations of violations, in Horn's case, we're still hearing about this, and that was for the 2010 campaign. So how effective are these when someone complains about them?
Well, you have to understand that the complaint is really designed to gather publicity. I mean, we got copies of the complaint probably before the Secretary of State's office, certainly at the same time. And, you know, how quickly can the Secretary of State do something? How quickly can Clean Elections? These investigations will take time, and my guess is will not be done by the time early voting starts in literally 4 weeks. So it's designed to kind of throw, as you say, a little bit of mud out there. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't something behind the complaint. But these complaints are made very publicly for a reason, to get our attention and then to circulate that among the voters.
Who's doing well in fundraising in the race for governor so far, and what does that indicate to you?
Well, it depends on how you define fundraising. Christine Jones has lots and lots of money. As of the last report, she had $2.3 million. Now, however, all but $200,000 that came out of her own wallet. Does that make her a successful fundraiser? Well, Yeah, I suppose she wasn't turned down by herself for the money. Scott Smith's got about $1 million. Doug Ducey has about $2 million. Most of that was not from his own campaign. He's got a lot of business interests, individuals and businesses contributing to him. Everyone else, you have to remember that Ken Bennett and Andrew Thomas are running with public funds. They'll have $750,000 to spend on the primary, and then more if they get to the general. So, you know, the money is all over the board. Obviously, money helps. It gets your message out. You know, Doug Ducey just started a new ad today on border security, on how he's going to, you know, spare no expense to put up fences and satellites and everything else. I'm not sure what he's paying for it with. But, you know, those sort of ads can make a difference, particularly in a low turnout primary, which, you know, could be.
How much do money and strategy have to go together? Can someone with less money but better strategy really make a dent or no?
Oh, you can do a lot with strategy. I mean, the issue for a lot of candidates is what they call in the business earned media. In other words, you do something that causes reporters like us to go out and cover it and give them, you know, free airtime. You can do a lot with earned media. We've certainly seen in many races people have put in bunches of money, not only in candidate campaigns, but in issues campaigns, and have been thoroughly defeated. You know, payday loans is a primary example. The industry, you know, spent, I think it was close to $2 million, and they still got trounced by a much lower financed group that was opposed to it. So you really need to have, you know, the message out there, and you need to be an attractive candidate also. You need to have people believe you. They need to look at your ads. They need to look at your material and say, I trust this person, and I want this person to be the next governor or whatever office we're talking about.
Any word on when Jan Brewer is going to tell us who she wants to be the next governor?
Well, actually, I just talked to her yesterday, and she said, you know, I'm still interviewing people, and I don't know. And I reminded her, I said, no, you do know the early voting starts in 4 weeks. She said, yeah, that's true. I think that it comes down to, you know, one of three possibilities. I think that, and I'm speaking based from, you know, not anything she told me, I think that she is most ideologically aligned with Scott Smith for two reasons. A, he supports for Medicaid expansion, which most of the rest of them don't, and B, he supports Common Core initiative and Common Core standards, again, which many of them don't. However, you know, she may also want to provide the strongest candidate to run against Democrat Fred Duval. That might end up being Ducey, and the polling will show that. And then option number three is, if you're not sure, stay the heck out of it. Mm-hmm. Because if you back somebody who loses, then, you know, your political credibility sort of falls apart. So I'm not laying money on any of those at the moment.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A couple more minutes with the Dean of the Arizona Capitol Press Corps, Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Howie, last night you covered the Clean Elections Horizon Republican Secretary of State debate. Will Cardin, Justin Pierce, Michelle Reagan. I think this is an important question because, as we've seen in Arizona so many times, the Secretary of State can then vault to governor. So what happened last night?
Well, it was kind of interesting because Ted Simons, who hosts the show for Channel 8, said to them, okay, what qualifies you to be governor? I mean, you know, we have had four times in the last four decades situations where the Secretary of State has become the state's chief executive. And Michelle Reagan said, well, you know, I've served in the legislature for 12 years. And, you know, when I talked to Jane Hull, who took over for Evan Meekum, she said it was that experience that helped her walk in, do a budget and everything else. And then, of course, slipping in, and I've been endorsed by Jane Hull, you know, hint, hint, nod, nod. Mm-hmm. Justin Pierce said, well, wait a second, I'm not chopped liver. I've been in the legislature, albeit for only 4 years. And then he said, but I have some real-world experience. I'm a partner at a major law firm, which then caused Will Cardin, who has no legislative experience, to say, you know, look, I have lawyers all the time. You know, they just give advice. You know, you need to be the one to make the decision. You'd be an executive like me. So each of them was trying to say, you know, I would be the best next governor. It's really important, as you point out, for anybody voting for Secretary of State to look beyond the fact that they're the state's chief elections officer and they do certain kinds of business filings and say, what would happen if this person were governor? And that's a real significant question in Arizona, given our history here.
Howie, last question, about a minute left here. So considering the issues Tom Horn's facing, John Hupenthal is facing, this was supposed to be potentially a pretty brutal year for Democrats. Could that be changing?
Well, a lot of it depends, obviously, on what happens in the primary. You know, Tom Horn faces a somewhat formidable challenge by Mark Brnovich, the former state gaming director. But Horn still continues to outraise Brnovich, which suggests he's got at least some backing, and that gets to the question whether money matters. Hupenthal is another question. You know, he's got a challenge from Diane Douglas, but she seems to be mostly a one-issue candidate about things like Common Core, which Hupenthal supports and she doesn't. A lot of it depends on who comes out of that. How do the Democrats benefit? You know, can Felicia Rodellini benefit from having Horn narrowly beat out Brnovich? Or if Brnovich wins, does Brnovich become a shoo-in? Same thing what happens in terms of Hupenthal and Diane Douglas. You know, how does a Democrat benefit from that? Who comes out of that? Obviously, from the Democrat perspective, I think their belief is they'd be better off with a Diane Douglas, who's sort of a narrow candidate, but you never know. You can do the calculus on this 62 different ways and still not know how it's going to all fall out.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
Very glad to be here.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll visit a Hindu temple in Phoenix, and we'll find out if the London Bridge in Lake Havasu City is truly falling down. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Local First Arizona, celebrating Independence Week now through July 7th, which reminds Arizonans that locally owned businesses keep more money in state. A golden ticket to shopping local is at localfirstaz.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and kjzz.org. Around the state right now, it's 83 degrees in Flagstaff, 95 in Tucson, sunny and 100 degrees in Yuma. Stay with us at 12 for Here and Now from Boston. It's mostly sunny and 100 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:43.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Recently, a map put together by the Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies showed which religious traditions have the second highest number of members in each state. In Arizona, behind Christianity comes Hindu. In a few minutes, we're going to take you inside a Phoenix Hindu temple. First, though, I talked with Caleb Simmons, who's an assistant professor of religion at the U of A, about religious affiliations in Arizona. I asked him whether there's anything about the state that would make it more diverse from the standpoint of faith.
Someone who actually is living in Arizona and sees a report that says, you know, the second largest religious tradition is Hinduism, and then someone saying, myself personally saying, that it maybe reflects that Arizona is not that religiously diverse, that might not necessarily ring true to their experience. Because, of course, whenever you talk about Christianity as being one tradition, that encompasses everything from, you know, Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox, different denominations of Protestant Christianity. And within that tradition, of course, the beliefs, practices, liturgy are wide-ranging, and some of them seem quite different from one to the next. So maybe a reflection of religious diversity is just different, and it exists as a diverse set of practices within the Christian tradition.
Is there something about Arizona that might make those who practice Hinduism more likely to have moved here? Is there more of a tradition here than we would have known about?
Well, I think that this is something that the map that was first published as part of the U.S. religious census and then later by Washington Post and then followed up with NPR is somewhat misleading, because if you look at the overall number of Hindu Americans in Arizona, the number is still very low. I've heard as high as about 2%, but most people actually say it's less than 1% of the total population. And so you're still talking about a very small segment of the overall demographics of Arizona. However, I think that number is going to continue to grow higher and higher because of the development in tech industry in Phoenix, in the greater Phoenix metropolitan area. And this is drawing some of the software engineers, technology engineers from India, because they're producing quite a few and they're really good at their jobs. So they're being attracted to American and international companies. And I think as the industry grows in Arizona, the amount of Indian Americans that come over is also going to increase, and that's going to lead them to importing in their religious traditions. And so you're just going to see a growth, especially in the metropolitan areas, of the Hindu traditions, and then that'll continue as you get into second, third, fourth generation Hindu Americans.
So is there some expectation of, as Hinduism and those who practice Hinduism grows in Arizona, is there a feeling that that might in some way influence the culture of the community?
Right. I think it will. I think this is also a trend in larger American popular culture. You can see it reflected. So now if you watch television shows, movies, you see a greater number of South Asian Americans being represented. And so I think overall it's starting to not only be represented within the culture, but it's starting to shape it more broadly. So you have, you know, different terms being incorporated in. I mean, terms like dharma and karma are now have, they're part of the American vocabulary, and they have been for a while. And I think you'll see the same thing emerging more and more as time goes on. And I think it also adapts the Hindu tradition. And so as Hindu Americans who are born here, are raised in the States, they also incorporate those American values back into the tradition. And so it's constantly this conversation that's going on back and forth between the Hindu tradition and American culture, and of course then the Hindus and Hindu Americans.
As our society, many would say, evolves and becomes more open or more tolerant, or however we want to phrase that, has that affected Hinduism as it has affected other religions as well?
The Hindu traditions are, like any other religious tradition, you know, so multi-layered and variegated, to where there's so many different things that are being imported in. I think that most of the conflicts that would occur within the tradition kind of get smoothed over because it's now a minority tradition. And so you have people from all over India bringing their different regional languages, regional practices. And so you kind of get this practice that's more inclusive. And so it becomes more, a little less rigid maybe. But at the same time, it's the Hindu traditions in America are often reflecting American values that don't necessarily correspond to all forms of Hinduism in India, such as being very text-centered. And so whenever I'm doing research in India and go to a temple, it's most of the people that I speak with haven't read a lot of the text that I talk about, but their religious education comes from different sources. But I think in America, the Hindu tradition often is reflecting a sort of idea of Sunday school and having that formal religious education centered around a text. In most cases, it's going to be like the Bhagavad Gita. And so it's just sort of a change in the way people come to know their own tradition.
Caleb Simmons, an assistant professor of religion at the U of A. After speaking with Professor Simmons, I visited some members of the Hindu community at the Ekdaman Deer Temple here in Phoenix to learn a little bit more about the religion and how it's practiced. When I got there, I was greeted by Uma Raman, a 20-year-old woman who's been volunteering at the temple and in the community for some time. I took off my shoes and she showed me through the front door. I immediately noticed the strong smell of incense and the sound of prayers being chanted. The temple is gorgeous and opulent. The floors appear to be made of smooth, light-colored stone. Beyond the entranceway is a large open room with chairs in the back and a raised section starting in the middle. That's where there were two priests leading rituals or puja. Sitting on rugs around them were a few dozen devotees who were getting ready to make a pilgrimage to a Hindu holy site in Tibet, Mount Kailash. Nearby was a plate of ritual offerings, including bananas and rose petals. And just beyond where the rituals were taking place were a number of shrines that featured different deities, which are the statues of the Hindu incarnation of God in different forms. Uma and five other community members met with me in a room just behind this area and talked with me about what Hinduism is to them and how it's practiced. They explain that Hinduism is an ever-evolving, individualistic belief system that is more a way of life than anything else.
The ultimate core belief of Hinduism is that there is one ultimate, supreme, formless God represented in the syllable Om, which we often say you might hear in meditation and things like that. And this God is pervades throughout the entire universe and is in every living being on all matter. And to represent this formless, abstract God, we worship these several different forms of this god and as different deities that you see in the temple.
Hinduism is not really any religion. It is the name that is there for Hinduism is Dharma. Okay, Dharma means duty. And the duty of any human being, that's what the principles of Hinduism give.
So if you look at it, it is ever evolving.
As time goes by, you come into new relationships and everything, and this religion will just adjust to it, you know, to, so that basically the idea being that you're doing good deeds towards your fellow mankind and any living being, or for example, Earth or the universe. Every person, if he follows the principles of Hinduism, is a Hindu. If you don't have to convert to Hinduism, it's a way of life. So if you follow the principles of being honest, being whatever the different forms can be, you know, if you follow that, you are a Hindu.
You don't need to go to the temple. A lot of people do have a small temple in their own home where they can pray and take care of the daily things. You don't have to run to this place if you live 30 miles from here every day to pray. Many people have deities installed at their home so they can do the same rituals at their home without any, in the comfort of their home.
God could be in you, in me, in our parents, teachers, and in that different form.
That was Nade Badri Raju, Vikram Shah, Amrish Bhagava, Kailash Raman, Mahesh Shah, and Uma Raman, who worship at the Akta Mandir Temple and are part of the Indo-American Cultural and Religious Foundation. One of the things they explained to us is that Hinduism is not a hierarchical religion. Still, there are priests who are responsible for performing certain rituals. This is priest Hari Joshi.
Every activity with religion, like are we giving first time food our children, we have to do worship and pray. Are we first time cutting hair, we have to do worship and pray. And like this, our every activity with religious. That's a priest is our very responsible duty.
And as I mentioned before, one of the things he and one other priest were doing that day was leading rituals and prayers for a number of devotees who were making a pilgrimage to Mount Kailash, a holy site in Tibet. The group's leader is Ashok Tripathi. He says that the group will hike 32 kilometers around the holy site, which is no small feat given its location and elevation.
So from Kathmandu, we can drive all the way up to 900 kilometers. So we drive to a place called Kodari, which is where we switch the border between Nepal and Tibet. We go to a place called Nyalam, and Nyalam starts at 12,000 feet. So we all did a hike on Mount Humphreys, and everybody was like huffing and puffing, and we did great at getting to the top. And I said, this is a great achievement to know how we get from the valley up to Mount Humphreys. It's difficult. Nyalam starts at 12,000, and then you go up.
One unique thing about the group Ashok is leading and the Akta Mandir Temple is that it includes people from all different parts of India and incorporates different customs that often vary regionally. In fact, the two priests I met, Hari Joshi and Sudarshan Abhat, were from different regions and chanted for us a mantra in the way that each of them is accustomed to.
Hari Om Gananantva Ganapati Gongava Mahi Priyanantva Priyapati Gongava Mahi Nidhinantva Nidhipati Gongava Mahi Vasumama Aham Jani Garbhadamma.
This is same thing he will chant now. Apguli.
Gananantva Ganapati Gongava Mahi Kavinka Venama Vamashramastavam Deshtara Jambrahmanam Brahmanaspata
Akta Mandir is one of around a dozen Hindu temples in the Phoenix area that collectively serve the growing number of Hindus in the valley. To see a slideshow of pictures from my visit to the Akta Mandir Temple, along with senior producer Sarah Ventry, visit kjzz.org. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We'll wrap up today's show. I'm joined by senior producer Sarah Venter. We hope you enjoyed the trek that Sarah and I made to the Phoenix Hindu Temple earlier this week. Sarah, what are some of the things that were not in that story that you still would want to relate to listeners, what we saw and what we heard?
It really struck me as such an inclusive religion and such an inclusive space. And I really loved the idea that you did not have to convert into the religion. You didn't have to self-identify as a Hindu to be a part of it. And I felt like once we got there, it was a really, really welcoming experience. I felt like even as an outsider, it was clear that people were happy to share a lot about their religion and about their personal lives with us.
I think the welcoming experience is what struck me as well. And in the course of it, I think obviously what drew us to this was this concept that Hindus make up the second highest number of devotees in Arizona. It seems like it's growing. It seems like the influence in Arizona is growing, but also the fact that it was such a part of the community in an area that both of us sort of presumed, this is sort of interesting, around 28th Avenue in Maryland.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like even when you're driving up to the building, it looks really different than a lot of the buildings around. So, you know, it's all white and it's really tall. It's big. It's got kind of a big parking lot around it that is also has these really kind of beautiful gates that kind of open and close as the temple opens and closes. Mm-hmm. And then across the street, there was a separate cultural center and reception hall for other bigger cultural events that happen. So it looks really different on the outside. And then, of course, as you described on the inside, it's very, very opulent. And even the architecture stands out from the area around it.
And as we mentioned, there's a slideshow at kjzz.org. Another part of this welcoming experience is how open people were to having you take photographs.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really kind of surprised. I think sometimes when you go into a holy site, you know, it's really a delicate situation. And it's important to sort of be aware of the fact that not everyone wants to be photographed, and that for many people, prayer is a very personal experience that they don't want to share with the rest of the world. But when we got there and I asked, you know, is it okay if I take photographs? Can I take pictures of the deities? Everybody was so welcoming and totally okay with it. And in fact, one of the members of the congregation walked around with me and kind of explained each particular deity and shrine to me, which was really wonderful.
And it seemed like people stayed a little bit later to help us out and help us learn more. And we didn't even learn all there is to learn. There's so much more.
No, obviously religion is really, really complicated, and there's no way that we could possibly understand it after just talking to a few people for one day. But it definitely, I think, gave us a really unique insight into a community that we probably would not have had an opportunity to experience otherwise.
So if you've never been inside a Hindu temple before, please go to kjzz.org. If you missed the story that Sarah and I put together on it, you can find that as well later this afternoon at kjzz.org. Senior producer Sarah Ventry, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much to Bruce Drummond for his help on today's Here and Now. Thank you very much for listening. Now we head to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ invites you to explore the great indoors this summer by visiting Arizona's museums and cultural institutions like SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, and Arizona Science Center, museums.kjzz.org.